Chapter 3. El Camino Real. Don Ramon de Saldaña, eldest son of Commandant Alvaro and Benita, was 66 years of age and sprightly in mind and limb. Often he reflected upon the three great joys in his life and the two inconsolable tragedies. He was sole owner of the vast Rancho El Codo, 25,000 acres named after an elbow of the Medina, that river which marked the boundary between the two provinces of Coahuila and Tejas. It was a rich and varied parcel, well watered, and stocked with thousands of cattle, sheep, and goats. Most important, it bordered a segment of Los Caminos Reales, that system of royal highways which reached out like spokes from Mexico City, the hub of New Spain. This portion reached from Veracruz through Mexico City to San Antonio de Béjar, as the town was now called, to the former capital of Tejas at Los Adais, and its presence along the ranch meant that Don Ramon could sell provisions to the royal troops that patrolled the vital route. Rancho El Codo was an inheritance of which he was justly proud. He was also inordinately pleased that he had, like his grandfather in Spain, sired seven sons in a row, without, as he boasted, the contaminating intrusion of a single daughter. The humorous honorific Hidalgo de Bragueta, Sir Knight of the Codpiece, was not customarily used in Mexico, but Don Ramon liked to apply it to himself. His third and chief pride in these declining years of a long frontier life was his granddaughter Trinidad, 13 years old, and as charming a child as could be found in the northern provinces. Petite and dark-haired, she was a lively young lady with a wonderfully free and outgoing nature, better suited to a canter over the Mesquite Range than to an afternoon of sipping hot chocolate with the mission friars. And although she was not a vain girl, preferring at this stage in her life a good horse to a pretty dress, she did like to look trim and paid attention to her appearance. The thing that strangers noticed most about Trinidad was her curious face, for although it was beautiful, with a flawless light complexion bespeaking her unsullied Spanish blood, her mouth was strangely tilted, creating the impression of a timeless smile. Her lower teeth had grown in most unevenly, preventing her jaws from meeting naturally, and this made the left corner of her mouth dip down while the right turned up. Had her other features been less than perfect, this defect might have marred her looks. Instead, it created a kind of additional interest, for when she came up ready to curtsy to a stranger, her unusual mouth seemed to be smiling inquisitively, as if to say, "Hello, what have we here?" And when she did speak, a very slight lisp or unevenness added to her air of mystery and to her attractiveness. She was a clever child. Her doting grandfather had taught her to read Cervantes, stories from the Bible, and even the less salacious of the romances being published in Mexico City. And a French cleric who had served some years earlier on one of Béjar's five missions had taught her his native language. She also had a marked talent for drawing, and so skillful were her rough sketches of people in the town that everyone who saw them could recognize this pompous priest or that officious occupant of the governor's residence. She was at her best, however, on horseback, for she was at that age when young girls are almost reluctant to face maidenhood and an interest in boys, and seek intuitively to cling to girlhood, lavishing their considerable affection on horses. In Trinidad de Saldaña's case, it was one particular horse, a spirited brown gelding called Relampaguito, Little Lightning Bolt. She would allow no one to abbreviate this rather long proper name, or to give her horse a nickname. He was Relampaguito, a horse of importance, and she cared for him as if he were a much-loved younger brother. It was Don Ramon's pleasure to ride forth in the early morning with Trinidad at his side, leave the town of Béjar, where the Saldañas had their townhouse, and ride toward the Misión Santa Teresa. From the Presidio, he would pick up an armed guard, and continue on to the edges of his ranch, whose new pastures, acquired from one of the Canary Island families, now reached eastward to those belonging to the mission. Grandfather and granddaughter rode easily, side by side, admiring the good work begun by Uncle Damian in building this mission, and later reveling in the splendid ranch the family had acquired through the energy and the agility of the Saldana brothers. At such times, Trinidad liked to ride on ahead, act as if she were a military scout, and call back, "I see Apache." Then both grandfather and granddaughter would race their horses toward some spot on the horizon and rein in as if they saw Apache campfires. Although once in a while Don Ramon would warn, "You must never joke about the Apache. At a place like that down there, my Uncle Damian was martyred and your father killed." And then the past became painfully real for the little girl. The great tragedy of Don Ramon's life was that, although he had sired 7 sons, all had died during his own lifetime. 4 in service to the king, 2 in Spain, 2 in Mexico. 1 of cholera, which swept the northern provinces periodically, and 2 tortured and scalped by the Apache. All were dead, and Don Ramon sometimes recalled bitterly the words of that wise ancient who said, "In peace, sons bury their fathers. In war, fathers bury their sons." In Tejas, it had always been war, threat of war against the French, real war against the Apache, comic war against the pirates who tried to infiltrate from the Caribbean, unending war against nature itself. And what made the slaughter of his sons so difficult to accept was that often the wars in which they engaged were later proved to have been unjustified. His 4th son, Bartolome, had been slain during a skirmish with the Austrians, and shortly thereafter, a solid peace with Austria came into effect. Same with the French. From his earliest days, Don Ramon had been taught to fear them, but now all the territories along the Mississippi River, which had once been French, were Spanish. And to make things even more bewildering, just a few years ago, a Paris-born Frenchman living in Natchitoches, had he but lived a little while longer, would actually have served as governor of Tejas. All his sons dead. Don Ramon, more than most, had witnessed the fearful price paid by those Spaniards who had sought to bring civilization to Tejas. The loneliness of the first missions, the years of unrewarded drudgery in the presidios, the martyrs among the friars, the slain heroes like his sons, the anguish of the governors who tried to rule without funds or adequate police facilities, and the backbreaking efforts of the good women like his late wife who supported their men, making each new house just a little more civilized, just slightly more removed from the roughness of the frontier. Once, when his sorrows seemed almost unbearable, he clasped his granddaughter to him and cried, "Trinidad, if this forsaken place ever becomes habitable, remember your fathers and your mothers who strove to make it so." She was 10 at the time, and said, "I have only one mother. I had only one father." And he swept his arms grandly over the entire town and cried with passion, "All the good Spaniards here are your fathers and mothers. They have all lived so that you might live. And you shall live so that those who come after, when this is a great city..." He kissed her head. "They will all be your children, Trinidad, yours and mine and Fray Damian's." "Even the Canary Islanders?" she asked, for relations with those proud and arrogant people had never been good. "Today even they are my brothers," Don Ramon said, but he had not really intended going that far. Don Ramon, his granddaughter Trinidad, and her mother Engracia, widow of Agustin de Saldana, slain by the Apache, lived in a beautiful, rambling, adobe-walled house facing the military plaza, that stretched westward from the still unfinished Church of San Fernando. Passers-by were charmed by the Saldanha home. Its walls are always so neatly whitewashed, and the seven wooden beams which jut out from the front wall are always hung with pots of flowers, or with golden gourds, or strings of corn and chilies drying in the sun. Don Ramon's house looks as if happy people live inside. Behind this inviting wall hid a nest of 11 interconnected small rooms forming a large horseshoe, the center of which was a lovely patio opening onto an even more beautiful garden, where stone benches faced a fountain that gushed cool water whenever Indian servants worked the foot pumps. No one who stepped inside this house or into the garden for even 2 minutes could deceive himself into thinking that it was a French house or English, and certainly it wasn't German. This was an evocation of Spain, set down in the wilderness of New Spain, and as such, it epitomized the ancient Spanish preoccupation with protecting families. Stout walls safeguarded them from outside terrors, and a tiny chapel enabled them to hold private religious services. And just as the house protected the family, so the family jealously guarded its prerogatives, prepared to do almost anything, including murder, to defend them. The Saldanha family was fighting to avoid submersion in a sea of mestizo and Indian faces, determined to resist intruders coming down El Camino Real from the new Spanish possession of Louisiana or from the uncivilized Yankee lands farther east and north. And therein lay the second tragedy in Don Ramon's life, festering, causing him nagging grief. His blood was pure Spanish. Nobody could challenge that. But it was of diminished quality because he had not been born in Spain. He was a criollo, not a peninsular. That honored name was reserved for those actually born in the Iberian Peninsula. Criollos could have pride. Peninsulares had glory. Since the only chance the Saldanhas of Béjar had to reestablish their honor was to marry Trinidad to some gentleman of Spain, this became almost an obsession with Don Ramon. And one afternoon in 1788, he said to Engracia, "Each day our little girl looks more like a woman. Please tell me how we can find her a suitable husband, a real Spaniard from Spain." Engracia Sarmiento de Saldanha, having been born in central Spain to a minor branch of the notable Sarmiento family and brought to Mexico, where her father served as governor of a province to the south, appreciated the wisdom of getting the Mexican Saldanhas back into the mainstream of Spanish life. "I never forget, Don Ramon, that your father Alvaro and your saintly uncle Damian, may God bless his soul in heaven, were true-born Spaniards. You, unfortunately, were not, through no fault of your own or your father's." Don Ramon took no offense at this sharp reminder of his deficiency. He was always ready to lament, even in public, that he was not a peninsular, and he had witnessed too many instances in which families of distinction from the best parts of Spain had slowly deteriorated in Mexico. "You've seen what happens, Engracia. They come here as proud peninsulares, and first they allow their sons and daughters to marry locals. Good families and all that, but born like me here in Mexico. With that relaxation to begin with, it isn't long before someone marries a mestizo. I've seen it a dozen times. Beautiful girls. Some sing like angels, sew well, keep a good house, tend their babies. But they are half Indian. And look what happens to their children. Look at young Alenon. He finally did it, married an Indian girl." He sighed at the incalculable loss. The famous Alençon blood lost in a desert of Indian adobes. "Is there any way we could send Trinidad to Spain?" her mother asked. "If Ignacio or Lorenzo had survived when they went to Spain, but they died. I suppose we have family somewhere. How about the Sarmientos?" My family would be very contemptuous of any girl born in Mexico. She said this without rancor or self-pity, but the manner in which her voice trailed off betrayed the enormous damage she had incurred by marrying a criollo. I knew our former governor, not well, but I did know him. You know what he said when he sailed home. May the Indian dust of this forsaken land never dirty my boots again. I doubt that he would welcome her. I've been thinking, Engracia, that perhaps you and I ought to travel down to Mexico City. If we started next year, in February, Trinidad would be 14. She's an extremely attractive girl, you know that. Her quizzical little smile, it tears my heart. And there must be many young officers from Spain. I would travel a great distance, Father, to find my daughter a proper husband. Let me speak to Veramendi about it. And so the serious discussion started, with Don Ramon walking sedately the three blocks that separated the Béjar residences of these two leading families. On Calle Soledad, for many years the only real street in town, the Béjar branch of the powerful Veramendis of Saltillo owned two elegant, many-roomed houses, facing a common patio which was itself a work of art. Seven old trees for shade, and graveled walks graced with statues carved by Indian workmen, who had copied Italian engravings of religious figures. Half a dozen niches in the adobe walls contained flower pots, holding vines whose creeping ends flowed down across the wall, forming beautiful patterns when the sun shone through them. In the larger house lived the head of the local Veramendis, an austere man who kept to himself, supervising the education of his many children. His very able son, Juan Martin, now 10, could already speak three languages, Spanish, French, and English, because the wise old man could foresee that these latter tongues were bound to become important in Texas. Don Ramon did not go to the big house, but to the smaller one, in which lived his good friend Don Lazaro Veramendi, of the lesser branch, who had granddaughters of his own, and therefore the same problems as the Saldanas. "Good day, dear friend," Don Ramon called out, as he entered the patio and saw Veramendi reading under one of the gnarled trees. "I remember the day that tree was planted. How many years ago?" The two men, each approaching 70, discussed the origin of this garden, and agreed that it must have been planted either just before or just after the arrival of the Canary Islanders, 60 years earlier. "Those were exciting days," Don Lazaro said. "And so are these. Do you feel the changes that overtake us?"
"I do."
He was about to specify what changes concerned him, when two of his granddaughters, girls of 11 and 14, ran onto the patio from one door of their home, past the flower beds, and through a door of the larger house. As they ran, the two old men studied their untrammeled movement. "It's them I've been thinking of," Don Ramon said. And when Veramendi looked up in surprise, Saldana added, "I mean all the girls of our families, our Trinidad especially. Where will she find a husband?" Before Don Lazaro could respond, he clarified his remark. "I mean, of course, a respectable Spanish husband. Where?" Veramendi, proud of his family's distinctions, astonished his friend by saying judiciously, "I no longer worry about that, Don Ramon. We're Spanish, yes, and proud to be. But neither you nor I was born in Spain, and we do well in Béjar. I think our children will do the same." "But maintaining the Spanish blood, things Spanish, a sense of Castile and Aragon, how can we ensure that if our granddaughters—"
"They'll marry as events dictate. And do you know one thing, Don Ramon? I doubt if any of them will ever see Spain. This is the new land. This is our homeland now."
"Wouldn't you prefer—" "How many granddaughters have you? 4, 5?
"I have 6, thanks to God's bounty," Veramendi said, "and 5 of them will need husbands. Maria's to be a nun by the grace of the Virgin, so we need only 5 young men.
And you'll be just as happy if they've been born in Mexico?
I was born in Mexico, and I yield to no man.
I mean, wouldn't you be just a bit prouder, more secure, I mean, if your girls were married to men born in Spain, men with honest Spanish roots?
Don Lázaro clapped his hands and laughed at his friend.
You have roots in Spain, the town of Saldaña, if my memory serves me, and what the devil good has it ever done you?
Don Ramón pondered this difficult question a long time, his brow deeply wrinkled. But then a benign smile appeared.
I often think of those dark centuries when Spain writhed under the heel of Mohammedanism. There was every reason for my ancestors to marry with the infidels, power, money, an appointment at the Moorish court. But they protected their Spanish blood with their lives. No Moors in our family, no Jews. We starved, lived in caves, and in the end we triumphed.
Do you feel about mestizos the way your ancestors felt about Moors?
I do. To be the carrier of pure Spanish blood fortifies the spirit. On that awful day, when messengers galloped in to inform my father that his brother, Fray Damián, had been tortured to death by the Apache, our family found courage in the fact that we were Spaniards, untouched by Mexico, and that as Spaniards we had to behave in a certain way to preserve our honor.
So what did your Spanish father do?
He handed me a gun, although I was barely 15, called for volunteers, and set forth to punish the Apache. We killed 67.
And what did that prove?
40 years later, the Lipan Apache were still there, and they killed 2 of your sons not 10 miles from where they killed your uncle.
Finally, we drove them back. In the end, Spain always conquers.
So in their place we got the Comanche, and they're worse.
Don Ramón fell silent, put his left thumbnail against his teeth, and studied this amazing Garamendi, who had from boyhood been so willing to accept Béjar as it was, never cursing the Indians, never brawling with the Canary Islanders, never arguing with the friars about the allocation of river water to the irrigation ditches. He had always whistled a lot, and now he whistled easily, as if any problems really worth serious worry lay far in the distance.
Don Lázaro, I don't think you'd worry, even if one of your granddaughters married a mestizo.
Garamendi pondered this and said, It seems highly likely, what with the dilution of our Spanish blood, that 2 or 3 of my girls might have to find their husbands among the locals.
When Saldaña gasped, Garamendi added an interesting speculation.
Let's be perfectly reasonable, Don Ramón. The Spanish army doesn't send many peninsulares to Mexico anymore, only a scattering of officers now and then, and damned few of them ever get north to this little town. We don't even get any peninsular priests anymore. Saltillo's no better. I looked last time I was down there. And in Mexico City, the grand families pick off the young Spaniards as soon as they arrive from Veracruz. So true Spaniards are gone. No hope at all.
That leaves young men like you and me as we were half a century ago. Spanish, but born in Mexico. And there's a limited number of us, believe me. I saw it in Saltillo. So what does that leave our granddaughters, yours and mine? It leaves a crop of fine young men, half Spanish, half Indian, and you have some of the best on your own ranch.
Saldaña was shocked. Would you allow a mestizo ranch hand to marry one of your granddaughters?
Garamendi, not willing to confess that he had been preparing himself for just such an eventuality, changed the conversation dramatically.
Do you want to know what I really think, old friend?
When Don Ramón said, I'm afraid to listen the way you've been raving, the old man said firmly,
I suspect that you and I are looking in the wrong direction. Right now we face south, looking always at Mexico City, from where God, in his merciful bounty, sends us all the good things we enjoy. Right now we look south along El Camino Real as our blessed lifeline. Dear friend, let's face realities. Let's change our position and look north. The good things of this life henceforth will not come up El Camino Real. They will come down it, from Louisiana or from Los Estados Unidos. When Don Ramon failed to respond, his friend said as he gazed north, "So what I really suppose is that my granddaughters will marry Frenchmen posing as Spaniards, or even worse, one of those rough Norteamericanos." "But aren't all Americanos Protestants?" "Men can change, especially where a beautiful girl's involved, and free land." Again Don Ramon was flabbergasted, whereupon Don Lazaro clapped him on the knee. "Since your little Trinidad is about the prettiest in town, you may find yourself completely surprised at whom she marries." At last Don Ramon found his voice. "By God, Don Lazaro, you sound as if you wouldn't even stop at Indians." "I don't want them for these girls," Don Lazaro snapped instantly, "because the Indians are not yet civilized. But the granddaughters of these girls, they might be very proud to marry the type of Indian who's going to come along." "When I was a boy, if the viceroy heard a Spaniard utter such a statement, off to the dungeons at San Juan de Ulua." At this, Veramente leaped from the stone bench, danced about the garden, and chuckled with delight. Then he took a position staring down at Saldana and reminded him of a few important facts. "2 years ago, I was sent by our viceroy to New Orleans to help our Spanish governor Miro bring that French city into our system, and I never worked with a better man. Judicious, far-seeing, patriotic. I wish we had a governor like that in Texas. He preached constantly to those below him that our new province of Louisiana was to be a haven for people of all kinds. French in the majority, Norteamericanos next in number, Spaniards of the better sort ruling fairly and running the businesses, with many, many blacks and Indians doing the work. All nations, and yes, unwisely, all religions. Governor Miro accepted everyone as his brother." Well, you can guess that his liberal attitude toward religion got him into immediate trouble because officials in Mexico supported the Inquisition, which is a fine institution if properly run. But Madrid sent out a wild-eyed, savage-spirited Spanish priest named Father Sadea to head our Inquisition. Yes, Father Sadea came out to New Orleans to establish religious courts, religious jails, and religious gibbets, from which he was going to hang every damned Protestant or freethinker like me, and maybe even Governor Miro himself. And when Louisiana was sanctified, he was going to hang all the Protestants in Texas. He had lists of names. He was a terrifying man, Don Ramon, and had he come down here, in due course you would have found yourself entangled in his webs. For what? I don't know. But he would have found something you had done or hadn't done. He was tall and very thin, and had deep-set eyes which darted from side to side, as if he constantly expected a dagger. Imagine, jails and gibbets established in Texas. Governor Miro assembled 8 of us he could trust, and asked us bluntly, "What can we do to save ourselves from this dreadful man?" And I said, "Murder him tonight." But Miro warned against such action. If we did that, Madrid would have to respond, and all of us would be hanged. A Spanish officer from Valencia, a pious man, I believe, for I saw him always in church, made the best proposal. "Let us arrest him right now and throw him onto the Princesa Luisa, which is ready to sail, and then hope that the ship sinks." A very wise priest born in Mexico City added the good touch. "We'll march him aboard at 10 in the morning with the whole town at the docks to jeer at him and laugh. We'll make a holiday of it, as if all Louisiana approved what we're doing, and that will draw Father Sadea's ugly teeth. So we had a festival, even the firing of a cannon. I arranged for that. And that's how we saved Tejas from the leg irons and gallows of the Holy Inquisition.
Don Ramon studied his knuckles, which had grown taut as the tale unfolded.
"Why do you tell me something for which you could still be thrown in jail?"
"Because it represents the new truth as I see it. Mexico City would never have dared oppose the Inquisition. New Orleans did. Down El Camino Real, from our new holdings in Louisiana, will come new interpretations of old customs. And along the same road, from Los Estados Unidos, will come new ways of doing things, a new sense of government, and lusty, energetic young men who will marry our girls."
"Will you permit that?"
"Who can stop it? Is the old Spain dead?"
"It's been dead for 50 years. I could have built a great city here. All it needed was 2,000 Spaniards of the better sort, ruling fairly, supervising things, and running the businesses. But they were never forthcoming. Spain had its chance, but passed it by."
The two men, debris from a flood of empire which had receded with terrible swiftness, sat gloomily for some minutes, seeing in imagination the royal road along which the promised help should have come but never did. Then, as if by malignant design, a bugle sounded from the presidio, and the army contingent marched out for one of its weekly parades, seeking to prove that Spain still had the power to defend its farthest outpost. Two aspects of the march impressed them when they went to the gate to watch: the slovenliness of the drill and the incredibility of the uniforms. Only the two officers, Captain Moncado and Lieutenant Marcelino, were properly outfitted. In gold trousers and smartly polished boots, they made a stiff and handsome pair, very military in appearance, except that Marcelino had no proper hat. He marched bareheaded, which made him seem 2 feet shorter than his commander, and somewhat ridiculous. The enlisted complement for Béjar was 94, but of these, only 64 had bothered to show up, and of those, only 2 groups of 3 each wore uniforms, but no one outfit was complete. The front rank wore fine blue uniforms, but here again, hats were missing. The second group, marching immediately behind, wore green uniforms that had been popular 30 years earlier. This time, only one hat was missing. The 8 men in the next 2 ranks also had uniforms, each one completely different, and behind them came 20 men dressed in either leather jackets or army trousers, but never both, and whichever half they did have was preposterously patched with cloth of another match. The next ranks wore no uniforms at all, only the floppy white garments of the countryside, and of these men, half had no shoes. They marched barefoot. Unbelievably, the last 15 in the parade had no hats, no shirts, no shoes. They marched in trousers only, and these of every possible length and style. At the front, Captain Moncado and Lieutenant Marcelino moved smartly and in step, as if they were on duty in Spain, as did the 6 enlisted men who had matching uniforms. But the rest straggled along, kicking dust, out of step, neither neat nor erect. For all the world, more like field hands returning to town at the end of a wearing day than soldiers representing Spanish dominion overseas. 2/3 of the troops had guns, but of every imaginable make and age. Surely, if the poorest dozen were fired, they could not be reloaded in less than 10 minutes. Some of the remaining men carried lances, shields, or swords, and many had no formal weapon whatever except a club hacked from some tree.
and this was the military might which was supposed to protect Bejar and its 6 missions, safeguard the roads, and defend the outlying farms from the skilled attacks of some 4,000 Comanche, those dreaded horse Indians from the north who had captured a few Spanish steeds, bred them, and galloped south to lay waste all Spanish settlements. This was the grandeur of Spain in the year 1788. Don Ramon, remembering how meticulous his father had been about maintaining the dignity of Spain when he occupied the Béjar Presidio, stalked over to the ramshackle building after the parade ended to rebuke Lieutenant Marcelino. "You could at least wear a proper hat." "The government provides us with no hats," the young man snapped. "We get damned little of anything, really." "If you had any self-respect, you'd buy your own." "We're supposed to, but we get no money." "And your men? Shocking. Can't you discipline them?" "If I say one unkind word, make one threat, they desert." "You should be ashamed of yourself, young man." And from that day, Don Ramon avoided the Presidio and its unruly complement, for he remembered when Spain was Spain. When Veramente learned of his friend's unfortunate run-in with the military, he said, "Old friend, you aren't going to like this, but the 2,000 real men who never arrived didn't have to be notable Spaniards like your ancestors and mine. They could very nicely have been Canary Islanders if they'd had the courage of that fellow who gave your father and uncle so much trouble." He whistled for one of his granddaughters, and when the girl Amalia appeared, a saucy child of 14 with bright eyes and big white teeth, he asked her to fetch a book from his desk. As she disappeared, Don Ramon asked, "Would you really let her marry a mestizo?" And Veramente said with a smile, "Who else will be left?" When the girl returned, Don Lazaro caught her by the hand. "Stay, I want you to hear this. I want you to hear how you should speak to little men who assume authority." Then, turning to Saldana, he explained, "This is a copy of the letter which our famous Canary Islander, Juan Leal Goras, sent to the Viceroy in Mexico City, demanding, not begging, for some additional right he was entitled to. Listen to how he begins his respectful plea. Juan Leal Goras, Español y colonizador, a las órdenes a su majestad, quien Dios protege, en su presidio de San Antonio de Béjar y Villa de San Fernando, provincia de Texas, también llamada Nuevas Filipinas, y señor regidor de esta villa, agricultor." Slapping his granddaughter lovingly on the shoulder, he said, "That's the kind of man we need in Texas. Give your full credentials like some dignitary, then sign yourself farmer." When the girl laughed, not understanding the force of what her grandfather was saying, he drew her to him, kissed her, and said, "And that's the kind of man I want you to marry, Amalia. Someone with spunk." When Trinidad learned that she would be traveling to Mexico City, she wanted to kiss her mother and her grandfather for their generosity. But she was so overcome by love that she stood in the white-walled room where they took chocolate in the afternoons and lowered her head for fear she might cry. Then a most winsome smile took possession of her curiously tilted mouth, and she gave a childlike leap in the air and shouted, "Olé! How wonderful!" She maintained this level of excitement for several days as the great trip was planned. Since it was over 1,000 miles to the capital, any citizen of Béjar would be fortunate to make the journey once in a lifetime. Trinidad, supposing that she would see the grand city once and no more, packed her 2 trunks with the greatest of care. Béjar at this time was not large, less than 2,000 inhabitants. But since the old capital of Los Adais had been abandoned, it had become the principal Spanish establishment north of Monclova. and because of a startling change in viceregal administration, it now had additional responsibility. A vast collection of provinces, including California, New Mexico, and Tejas in the north, along with six huge provinces like Coahuila and Sonora to the south, had been united to form the Provincias Internas, with their capital at Chihuahua. But since this city was 500 miles to the west and connected only by Indian trails to Béjar, most local decisions had to be made in the Tejas capital. For extended periods, Béjar was left on its own.